This is Free Speech Radio News. It's Friday, February 22nd, 2008. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, Homeland Security focuses its attention and budget on securing the Mexican border. Massive protests in Serbia against the independence of Kosovo fuels nationalism and violence. And the firing of the progressive president of William & Mary College in Virginia causes outrage on campus.
He goes to football games. He helps kids move in the beginning of the semester. He makes great speeches. He's just a very charismatic man.
All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Thousands of Turkish troops have pushed into northern Iraq to crack down on Kurdish separatists. The Turkish army began their ground invasion late Thursday after giving prior notice to U.S. and Iraqi authorities. The Pentagon has acknowledged sharing intelligence data with Turkey and says it will readily supply information regarding potential PKK targets. The PKK, or Kurdistan Workers' Party, has been calling for an independent homeland for Kurdish people, who live predominantly in areas of Turkey, Iraq, Iran, and Syria. The governments of the U.S. and Turkey consider the PKK a terrorist organization. Turkey started to build up troops along its shared border with Iraq in October of last year, triggering concern that military action could destabilize one of the calmest regions of Iraq. A Pentagon spokesman told reporters today that the Pentagon has, quote, strongly urged the Turkish government to bring any ongoing operations to a swift conclusion. In other news, Iraqi Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has extended his militia's ceasefire for another 6 months. Al-Sadr first ordered his Mehdi army to cease attacks on other militias, Iraqi police, and U.S. troops in August of last year. The ceasefire was set to expire tomorrow. The newfound power of Pakistani opposition parties could threaten secret plans to intensify America's military drone strikes within the country. The New York Times reports U.S. officials worry the new political leaders might annul arrangements made in January with President Pervez Musharraf's government to loosen rules for American forces in their attacks in Pakistan's tribal regions. Zach Badorf reports from Islamabad.
Two leading Pakistani politicians agreed late last night to form a coalition of their two parties in the parliament, though rule by national consensus. When reminded of the president's stated willingness to work with other political parties, opposition leader Nawaz Sharif responded, "What help do we need from Musharraf?" The new coalition could scrutinize the new, looser rules of engagement for American military attacks against suspected Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants inside Pakistan. The Times reports the strikes are launched from a secret CIA base in Pakistan, with a handful of unmanned aircraft called Predators controlled from the U.S. During his visit to Pakistan earlier this week, Senator Joe Biden said the Pakistani army is stretched relatively thin in its fight against Al-Qaeda and Taliban militants.
There are two things: will of the Pakistani government and capacity of the Pakistani military. I think we have underestimated the will and overestimated the capacity.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Islamabad.
An Israeli airstrike killed two Palestinian fighters in Gaza today, just one day after the European Union's parliament criticized the Israeli blockade of the coastal region as collective punishment. FSRN's Rami Almagheri has more.
An Israeli airstrike early this morning killed two members of the Islamic Jihad in central Gaza after a number of fighters clashed with an Israeli undercover army force in the town of Megazi. The Israeli army has carried out a series of attacks on Gaza in the past 2 weeks, including small-scale ground invasions and shootings aimed at Palestinian fighters. According to an Israeli army radio report on Thursday, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert says he prefers pinpoint attacks to large-scale offensives in the coastal strip. Last week, Olmert gave his army a free hand to launch attacks on Gaza. Meanwhile, the EU Parliament yesterday lambasted the Israeli blockade of Gaza as collective punishment and called on the ruling Hamas party to stop homemade rocket fire into nearby Israeli towns. Hamas welcomed the position of EU's lawmakers but says the rockets are a response to the continued Israeli actions against the Gaza Strip. Israel has enforced a crippling closure on Gaza's 1.5 million residents since the Islamist Hamas party took over the region in June of last year. For Free Speech Radio News, I am Rami Almagheri in Gaza.
During his visit to Colombia yesterday, France's foreign minister confirmed that the FARC guerrillas are planning to release a fourth hostage to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez. Manuel Rueda has more from Bogotá.
The identity of the fourth hostage has not officially been confirmed, but all signs point to former Senator Jorge Gachem. He was kidnapped in 2002 and is reportedly very ill. Gachem's family could travel to Caracas, Venezuela's capital, in the following days, where they would join the relatives of three ex-congressmen whose pending liberation was announced by the FARC in early February. Venezuelan government sources have told the families that their relatives will be released by Tuesday. And today, President Chavez canceled a state visit to China, another sign, experts say, of an imminent release. If the liberation is successful, this would be the second time that the FARC has released hostages to the Venezuelan president. In early January, Venezuelan military helicopters picked up two FARC hostages in Colombian territory, and the following day, Chavez urged the Colombian government to recognize the FARC as an armed insurgency group, rather than as a terrorist organization. For the Colombian government, Chavez's statements are an unwelcome intrusion in its internal affairs, and security experts in this country worry about Venezuela's ties with the Colombian guerrillas. As a result, President Uribe has said that he wants to work with European countries and not Venezuela to release the remaining hostages. But the FARC only want to negotiate with the Venezuelan president. Manuel Reda, FSRN, Bogota.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
Thursday's Democratic debate in Austin between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama was a historic event for Texas voters. The state hasn't been a pivotal player in a national election since the 1970s. The prolonged primary season this year has brought the candidates' attention to the concerns of Texas progressives. Although the debate focused primarily on national concerns, candidates did speak to an issue of particular interest to many in Texas, the construction of the so-called border wall in the Rio Grande Valley, a thriving area whose economy operates on both sides of the U.S. border with Mexico. Ann Raber has followed the border wall issue for FSRN and was at last night's debate.
The two remaining candidates for the Democratic Party's presidential nomination met last night at the University of Texas in Austin before the state's primary election on March 4th. When the topic turned to immigration in last night's debate, CNN's John King brought up an issue that has crowded the front pages of South Texas newspapers for almost a year, yet has remained in the margins of the national media.
Stay on the issue, but move to a controversial item that was not held up when the immigration debate collapsed in Washington, and that is the border fence.
King spoke to the concerns that Texas border residents have with a barrier that may not apply in other states where the border runs through sparsely populated desert. The South Texas border is a thriving international center where the border fence, or wall as opponents call it, threatens to destroy the homes and businesses of people living on both sides of the river. King directed his question to Senator Clinton.
As President of the United States, would you commit tonight that you will finish the fence and speed up the construction, or do you think it's time for a President of the United States to raise his or her hand and say, you know what, wait a minute, let's think about this again, do we really want to do this?
Clinton, fresh from her campaign trip to the Rio Grande Valley, responded with clear disapproval of the current plan for the barrier's construction.
What I've said is that I would say, wait a minute, we need to review this. There may be places where a physical barrier is appropriate. I think when both of us voted for this, we were voting for the possibility that where it was appropriate and made sense, it would be considered. But as with so much, the Bush administration has gone off the deep end.
Senator Obama concurred with his opponent and her suggestion for revising the country's plan for increased border security.
This is an area where Senator Clinton and I almost entirely agree. I think that the key is to consult with local communities, whether it's on the commercial interests or the environmental stakes of creating any kind of barrier.
Although there is promise in the candidate's words and in the national attention last night's debate brought to the issue, there are 11 long months before a new administration comes into office that might revise the plan for a border wall. Department of Homeland Security officials continue to insist that the border wall be built according to the current plan, and area residents and politicians continue to oppose it. For Free Speech Radio News in Austin, this is Ann Raber.
In related news, the Department of Homeland Security has released its annual report, which almost exclusively focuses on the southwestern border. Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff plans to increase prosecution of employees who hire undocumented workers and continue to expand fencing and high-tech surveillance across the Mexican border. At a press conference at the Department of Justice today, Chertoff revealed plans for the upcoming fiscal year. Homeland Security has seen a 6.8% increase in its federal budget, while nearly all other domestic programs have seen cuts or no increases at all. From Washington, D.C., Catherine Jarmel reports.
Department of Homeland Security Secretary Michael Chertoff plans to increase prosecution of employers who hire undocumented workers and continue to expand fencing and high-tech surveillance across the southwestern border. According to the annual report released today, Homeland Security made more than 850 worksite arrests.
I'm delighted to say it's part of our effort to continue to make it less appealing for people to break the law. We will soon publish our regulation with the Department of Justice to increase civil fines on employers, as we announced last August.
Chertoff highlights workplace crackdown, but the focus continues to be on the worker, not the employer. Of the 850 arrests, less than 100 were of the employer. Critics of electronic verification program called E-Verify say the process is used in a discriminatory way. John Amaya, legislative staff attorney for the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund.
The system is flawed in the sense that people are using that as a screening method to either not hire or potentially let go of candidates, and it's discrimination. They're using it as another tool to discriminate from hiring certain employees.
Amaya also warns that without comprehensive reform, workplace abuses toward immigrant workers, both documented and undocumented, will continue. Friday's announcement also gave the green light to a virtual wall between Mexico and the U.S. Although physical barriers will still be built, additional money will be pumped into towers, cameras, sensors, and radars. Contractor Boeing Company was already awarded a $15 million contract called Project 28. This announcement will complete and expand the project, even though it was proven to be complicated and technologically challenging. Critics say the price will be phenomenal. As presidential candidates talk about using high-tech measures and increasing public oversight, Chertoff argued that public oversight can only go so far. In response to a question about landowners who are upset about the department's use of eminent domain, he said those people, quote, don't care about national security.
We tried to visit with people in town hall meetings. Some people either ignored the request or simply said, as a matter of principle, they don't believe in fence. They're entitled to their principles. I respect that. I respect private property. But you cannot make border security and national security an individual choice for each individual landowner.
Amaya says immigration often evokes personal views, and that Homeland Security doesn't seem to have a problem with personal views that are in agreement with their politics.
So many decisions have been made in the name of national security, but we know that they're personal decisions, and they're taking place all over the country. And when we see Prince William County being asked where they come up with the whereases in their preambles, that discuss, for example, you know, whereas their way of life is diminished, whereas the crime has risen, and they're asked specifically, how do you justify this? Well, it's a personal decision. And so for it to work in one context and not in the other, such as eminent domain, is very hypocritical.
Chertoff said plans for a mixture of the wall and other surveillance would continue, and that his department will try to continue to accommodate landowners. But he insinuated that citizen complaints might fall on deaf ears. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
Podcasts and transcripts of Free Speech Radio News can be found online at www.fsrn.org. There, listeners can also comment on the day's stories and participate in discussion forums. That's online at fsrn.org. Massive riots in Belgrade, Serbia, protesting last week's declaration of independence of Kosovo, has triggered condemnation from much of the international community. Today, the United States pulled all non-essential diplomats and American families out of the country in response to yesterday's burning of their embassy. One charred body was found, but it doesn't appear to be that of an embassy employee. Instead, U.S. officials believe it was one of the protesters. The Turkish, Croatian, German, and British embassies were also attacked. The European Union has demanded the Serbian government offer protection for foreign personnel, saying not doing doing so could hurt the country's prospects of ties with the EU. Amy Miller reports from Belgrade.
A highly emotional nationalist demonstration was organized yesterday by the Serbian government, where over 250,000 people took to the streets under the banner of Kosovo is Serbia. Prominent speakers spoke out against countries that have recognized Kosovo independence, fighting against Western domination and the bombing of Serbia in 1999. Film director Amir Kusturica from last night's speech.
The Clinton administration bombed Belgrade and Kosovo, so hundreds of thousands of our people left from there. Before that, the same administration made a supervision of the expelling of Croatian Serbs from Knin and Kninska Krajina.
Although the U.S. embassy has been attacked earlier this week due to its support of Kosovo's independence, and thousands of riot police were on duty yesterday evening, only a handful of regular police officers were protecting the embassy when the demonstration arrived. Fires set off by Molotov cocktails burned down a small part of the building, and one person is reported to have died. Mixed reactions have come from the Serbian government, with members speaking both for and against the violence. Velimir Ilic is the Minister of Infrastructure and member of the ultra-nationalist party New Serbia. Here we hear his public statement given this morning to BBC Serbia.
Young people reacted and Serbian youth did not shame us. They went out and showed they protest. Some of them are being called hooligans. Somebody calls them all hooligans. But it shouldn't be done like that. Those young people that came out to show their revolt, their protest for sure had good intentions. They opposed great injustice that cancels the centuries of our existence on these lands.
Recent polls show that over 70% of the population in Serbia thinks that Kosovo should remain within Serbia, often citing it as their cultural, historical, and religious homeland. Other historical facts are most often omitted. Amnesty International released a statement today condemning the widespread violence, intimidation, and threats within Serbia that have been made towards Albanian, Muslims, NGOs, grassroots organizers, and media who have expressed dissenting views towards the status of Kosovo. Majda Puača from Antinato Beograd explains.
Obviously, Kosovo is not Serbia, and it's not been like that for many, many years now. Both in Serbian and in Albanian, there's so much nationalism from all sides, but nobody is actually talking about the dialogue. Like, you cannot just, okay, declare independence or have Kosovo in Serbia, but you don't actually do anything to reconcile people. You're just talking about territory, but you are not talking about people who actually live there.
The Serbian government rejected a Western design ultimatum at the Rambouillet conference, which would have given NATO countries complete access to what was then the Serbo-Montenegrin territory with total impunity. This led to a further escalation of the conflict in Kosovo between the KLA, an ethnic Albanian paramilitary group who has strong ties to organized crime, and the Serbian military. From this, NATO justified its bombing campaign of Serbia in 1999. The war ended with defeat of Serbian forces and the creation of UN Resolution 1244, which gave the power of administration of Kosovo to the UN. The United States was instrumental in its creation. The Kosovo parliament state that Sunday's declaration of independence was the next logical step to come out of Resolution 1244, while Serbia officials argue that it is breaking international law and their constitution. The United Nations is meeting on Monday for another special Kosovo session and will hear from Serbian President Boris Tadic. All 15 countries of the UN Security Council sent a unanimous statement condemning the last night's violence against the embassies, leaving many to wonder how much of an isolationist route Serbia is willing to take over Kosovo. Reporting for FSRN from Belgrade, Serbia, this is Amy Miller.
This week, Bolivia formally withdrew from the U.S. Army's Training Institute in Fort Benning, Georgia, better known as the School of Americas. The school was renamed the Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation in 2001. Following Venezuela, Costa Rica, Argentina, and Uruguay, Bolivia is the fifth Latin American country to cut ties with the training center because of its historic links to military dictatorships and human rights abuses throughout the hemisphere. Juliet Beck and Aldo Orellana Lopez filed this report from Bolivia.
This week, the Bolivian government made formal its decision to no longer send military personnel for training to the U.S. Army's Western Hemisphere Institute for Security Cooperation in Fort Benning, Georgia, which, according to Bolivian General Luis Trigo, functioned at the service of U.S. interests. Father Roy Bourgeois, founder of the campaign to shut down the U.S. Army's Institute, formerly named the School of the Americas, lived in Bolivia during the military dictatorship of Hugo Banzer. Banzer himself received training at the school in 1956 and was later inducted into the school's Hall of Fame.
Yes, well, let me just say, I went to Bolivia in 1972 as a member of the Mirano community, and the poor of a barrio in La Paz became my teachers for the next 5 years. It's really where I got my education about Latin America. Bolivia was under General Hugo Banzer, the brutal dictator, and the men with the guns were running the country. It was in my fifth year that many were arrested. The repression intensified. The jails were filled with university students and tin miners and others. And it was in my fifth year that I was among the many arrested, and I was forced out of the country and then returned to the United States.
Father Roy began his fight to close the school after six Jesuit priests and two women were killed in El Salvador in 1989 by soldiers trained at the School of the Americas. Since its founding in 1946, over 61,000 Latin American troops have received training at the U.S. taxpayer-funded facility. According to the School of the Americas Watch organization, the Pentagon admitted in 1996 that the school's training manuals advocated torture, coercive interrogation techniques, and extrajudicial executions. In recent years, Bolivian troops primarily received anti-narcotic training, and many returned to the Chapare region, where the coca leaf, an ingredient used in producing cocaine, is grown. Coca is considered a sacred leaf in Andean culture and chewed and brewed as a nutritional tea. Isabel Chuquimia, with the Institute for Therapy and Investigation of Torture in Bolivia, described the lasting effects of the low-intensity warfare during the late 90s to eradicate coca.
Hay mucha gente que ha perdido uno de sus miembros.
There are many people that lost a body part or a family member. There were disappearances, deaths. We believe that the soldiers trained in the School of Americas left not just physical scars, but also psychological wounds in all of the region. This in a country where supposedly democracy exists.
Donde supuestamente existe democracia.
Bolivia made its decision to withdraw from the school formal in a letter to the commander in charge of the institute, Colonel Gibraltar Perez, who said he would respect the decision of President Evo Morales, but found it unfortunate that Bolivian soldiers would not be attending the institute because, quote, the participation of Bolivia not only with the U.S., but with other countries of the hemisphere is an important opportunity to exchange knowledge and experiences. This past week, Father Roy met with President of Ecuador, Rafael Correa, and Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua, both of whom knew little about the numbers of troops being sent to the Army's training school in Fort Benning, and pledged to look into the possibility of no longer sending troops next year.
And it's so good to see again countries that are beginning to, you know, plot their own destiny and talking about sovereignty and dignity of their country and of their people. So this is extremely encouraging.
For Free Speech Radio News, this is Juliet Beck and Aldo Oriana Lopez reporting from Cochabamba, Bolivia.
The recent resignation of the president of the College of William and Mary has unleashed uproar about freedom of speech on campus. President Gene Nickel, who moved William and Mary in a progressive direction by promoting diversity and freedom of speech, resigned his post last week after being informed that the Board of Visitors would not renew his contract. This week, a member of that board resigned in protest to the firing. Many students have passionately denounced the firing as ideological, but criticisms of the president's management skills persist. Tanya Snyder reports.
Gene Nickel was a popular president at the College of William and Mary.
He goes to football games. He helps kids move in the beginning of the semester. He makes great speeches. He's just a very charismatic man.
That's Andy Zahn, editor-in-chief of the college newspaper. President Nickel was also widely praised for instituting policies which increased race and income diversity on campus. But Nickel started to get in trouble in 2006 when he removed a cross from the campus chapel, saying that he wanted to make the chapel more welcoming to students of all faiths. Last month, his reluctant decision to allow a student group to sponsor an on-campus sex workers art show provoked harsh criticism from Virginia state legislators, some of whom called an extraordinary meeting with college board members at the state capitol to discuss Nichols' performance as president. Jonathan Knight, director of the Department of Academic Freedom, Tenure, and Governance for the American Association of University Professors, says that it's inappropriate for the Board of Visitors to respond to political pressures.
The firing leaves the impression that the board was taking this action in response to the legislators. That may or may not be the case. I hope it's not the case. But unfortunately, there was that impression left by their action, and that cannot be good for academic freedom.
The rector of the Board of Visitors that dismissed President Nichols is Michael Powell, son of former Secretary of State Colin Powell and the former chair of the Federal Communications Commission. Powell is on record as saying that the decision not to renew Nichols' contract was unanimous. But today, board member Robert Blair resigned in protest, making it clear that there was serious dissent among the board. While Blair maintains that the decision was based on administrative and not ideological concerns, he said that he was resigning because of, quote, mean-spirited communications that are not worthy of the professional deliberations of any managing board. Students held a candlelight vigil to protest the board's decision not to renew the president's contract, but criticisms of Nichols' administration continue. Again, Andy Zahn.
He was almost idolized on campus because he was so involved with students. A lot of students aren't aware of his fundraising missteps, of his administrative missteps.
Nichols says he rejected a substantial economic incentive to remain quiet about the situation and to not say he was targeted for ideological reasons. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tanya Snyder.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Our newscast is supported by Pacifica Radio, community radio affiliate stations, and listener supporters. We podcast at www.fsrn.org. That's fsrn.org. You can email us your feedback, questions, and story ideas to comments@fsrn. Today's newscast was produced by Monica Lopez and Tana Gousset, headlines editor Shannon Young, DC editor Leanne Caldwell, and the technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley, Antonio Ortiz, Eric Klein, Puck Lowe, and Rose Kitabchi. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.